Probably the main points of what we've got to say are in that handout. So you probably don't need to write anything down. And there's going to be a podcast, I understand, of this, so you can just relax, sit back and try and enjoy the moment. A podcast, I'll explain to you. The project, as you can see, was not just involving us. So Charlene Schwartz at the HSRC was very, very important in the project, as were our colleagues in Tanzania, Shalina Wali, Musa Mohammed. Let me give you some background first, then, as to why we should engage in projects such as this. In sub-Saharan Africa, as most people know, sub-Saharan Africa is the part of the world that has suffered most from HIV/AIDS. And we now know that that new infections have peaked in 1996. But this is still a substantial problem. Because the problem is not growing doesn't mean it's not still a problem. And South Africa in particular's epidemic remains the largest. 40% of all women in the world with HIV live in Southern Africa. And 14 million children have been orphaned in sub-Saharan Africa. If you think about that figure just for a moment, it's an extraordinarily enormous figure. And what we do know is that education has had an impact, not just schooling, but education of all sorts. Education, community education in particular, was absolutely seminal in many countries. And hence the phrase that education has become the social vaccine. And one of the really cheering things is that the fall is biggest amongst the group that is most vulnerable, which is the 15-ish, the adolescent age group. So education is having an impact, and it's having an impact on behaviour and therefore having an impact on life. So that's why we undertook the project. And I think we started, we started from the hypothesis, because there are hundreds of HIV/AIDS education programs, curriculum, every country has its policy, and there are loads and loads of classroom programs, materials produced by NGOs and the like. But what we know, and I know from colleagues here, who from doctoral students' work and other work, is that that isn't what's occurring. Now, that's not just a problem in Africa. That's an international problem with sex education or sexuality education. So we started from three core assumptions. One, that this is a sociocultural problem. It's not a problem of educational resources or materials, primarily. It's a problem where we have to find a way of looking at HIV/AIDS education in its sociocultural context. And second, that part of the problem was that there was this almost, in a sense, pretense about education in schools, that it was because you had the curriculum and you had the policy, it was happening, and that it met the needs of young people. So that's that. We wanted also to challenge that. And so we took these three core theoretical positions. One, first I need to go back a bit. ASCAIDS 1 is this project. We are engaged in ASCAIDS 2, and we always had a two-step process in mind. So ASCAIDS 1, this project, is about pure research. And the aim of it was to find out what is it that young people already know about sexuality education, where do they learn that? And then the second phase, which I'm not going to talk about tonight, but maybe this time next year, is what would happen if you based a curriculum development around these ideas, which is what we've been doing for the last year. So three core theoretical positions, that this is a sociocultural problem and that you have to look at it in that context. That consulting pupils is a very, very powerful way of moving things forward. And this idea that Bernstein has, that there are two sorts of knowledges and knowledge discourses. There's the one that happens in school, the formal discourse of schooling and the formal knowledge of schooling, and there's the informal of what happens outside of school. And I guess what we're arguing, and what our Gates 2 is about, is can you put these two together? Can you actually create what Bernstein calls a hybrid project, which draws on out-of-school knowledge and uses that knowledge in school? So you'll see why we've got a third concept, which by the end of the project was absolutely crucial to us, and that was the concept of dialogue. So there are our research questions, two very straightforward questions. What are the primary sources and contents of sexual knowledges for young people? And how do these knowledges differ in terms of content and process of acquisition? And how do these knowledges interact with AIDS education received in the classroom? And how might young people's sexual knowledge be used to affect change in pedagogy and curriculum? So those are our two core research questions. Our research design was to take, because this was intended to be quite an in-depth qualitative study, 8 schools in 3 countries, partly this was capacity, so 3 in Mombasa, Kenya, 3 in Dar es Salaam, and 2 in Cape Town, South Africa. The other thing we were interested in was we were interested in contexts where there was poverty and deprivation. So we weren't interested in looking at the most affluent context. We chose primary, and I can remember vividly a conversation with Alicia about this, about whether what age group should we work in. We chose primary quite deliberately because it is the last year in all those contexts of entitlement to education for all, and also because we felt the age issue was a very important one, and we'll come back to that. And there are the numbers. We also engaged with community stakeholders. So you'll see how we engaged with them. And by that we mean parents, chiefs, PTA members, clerics, village elders. And and Sue's going to take you through some of the data we have. We're not going to go through it all, but these were the methods we used of lesson observation, to establish what actually was going on, and this what's called rapid ethnography, which is basically a way of looking in depth for a shorter period than a normal ethnography would, at the context, the setting of the village, or the area of the school, as well as looking at the routines and the school at work. In-depth interviews, mini-video documentaries. The documentaries were young people giving us two things. Sex education, we gave them a camera and said, go make a little mini-documentary, about 3 minutes or something, and you'll see some of those. One was of the situation, sex education as it actually is now, and those we haven't shown to anybody for ethical reasons. And sex education as you would like it to be, and those we did show to the teachers and to other people. Focus groups of teachers, pupils, and interviews with teachers, pupils, and stakeholders. And then right at the end, we brought everybody together, and we showed them the data, some of the data that we're going to show you to see what would happen. So, let me just say before Sue talks about the ethics of this, we've got permission to use all the photographs that we have here. We don't think there aren't ethical issues around this. There are. We'll happily debate those with you afterwards. But we have cleared them with the people who appear. In some of the student photos, what look like real-life situations are actually role plays. And we'll enact those with you. Well, Sue will tell you when they are. So this was our research on what their knowledge was and where they acquired their knowledge from and what sort of knowledge they were acquiring. And then the next step, and having interviewed the teachers, and was in a sense to stand back and see what happened if we shared this information with everybody. And so what we did was we held a conference very similar to this, where we called all the participants together, and we, so the community stakeholders were there, the teachers were there, pupils were there, and we showed them the photos, we showed them the videos. And I think even we were not quite prepared for what then happened, which was an extraordinary dialogue between the adults and the children. The first thing was the shock, because there was this deep belief, as there is here, that young people are innocent, that they don't notice sex in their world. I mean, many of the data that we were seeing here are no different here in the UK or with international research. So we know that most young people have had their first sexual experience by the age of 13. We also know they regret it. So there was a shock, but there was also, and this I was quite amazed at, an appreciation of, in a sense, being told, which is not what I was expecting, and an awareness and respect. And now, this is a typical example of what actually happened. This is just an extract of the a section of the dialogue where the teacher is... this is the adults talking. So this is a discussion between the female chief and the teacher, and you can see the beginning of a shift in this. I'll give you a minute to read that. So what we see is some really interesting things happening from a position of not talking. First of all, I think the teacher is actually sharing some of her dilemmas, and that's really, really important, because... the teachers are caught in between the community and the policy, as it were. And so one of our aims was to start a conversation so that we could actually bridge some of that divide. And here you see some of that happening. And you see a bit more openness, because one of the things we haven't talked about is that many of these African countries that this study was in, it is taboo for adults to talk to young people about matters of sexuality. So this is quite a step forward. In the second example, you see the boy starting to talk, and you start to see a debate, and you start to see him opening up and starting to ask some of the questions that he really wants to ask. So I'll give you a chance to read that. Mr. Mbogo is a teacher. You can see that he's a little surprised that this boy is asking this question. But that's the sort of classic example of the question the boy wants to ask, and in the sense of what we were talking about, of that hybrid curriculum. And the complications of children's questions, which many of you already know about. Okay, so what can we conclude from this first, or what have we concluded from this first phase of the research? Well, first, in a sense, it's a challenge to this notion of children as innocent, passive agents who are totally dependent on adults, and we decide when and what they know and what they should know. So one of the things we see here is that children are knowing and they are active and they live in a highly sexualized world. And that actually the opposite is true. The quote about who would want to experiment with AIDS is absolutely right. They are at risk if we treat them as innocent. So somewhere we have to find a position of engaging with children somewhere between innocent and somewhere between knowing. We're not advocating everything. But there's a very interesting book by Faulkner, which we use quite a lot, which is about why is it so important for us to see children as innocent? Why is it so important for us to construct children as innocent? And we're arguing, I think, that we would want to argue for children to be seen as agents and citizens who can be involved in a deliberative and democratic practice, which is responsibly undertaken. Second major area is to do with teacher preparation. And again, this is not new, but what our research also confirmed is that The teachers have the materials and they have the policy, but they don't have the confidence or the preparation. And these cultural barriers are huge. So what we've heard is people teaching maths instead of teaching life skills, or sticking to the facts because the facts are safe, sticking to the disease because the disease is safe. We were interested that schools adopted very different positions, and this has continued in the next phase of the report. Some schools saw themselves as change agents within the community. And I know this is something that I've spoken quite a lot with Moses about, but in a sense, what there is a possibility for the school to be seen as an agent and to have the permission that maybe the cultural norms don't allow other people. So there's a perception of the school, and I think this is really, really important, as a possible leader. And in many of the communities, it's seen as okay for the school to do that, but not for the community elder to do that. And so we concluded, and this is in a sense what we've engaged in Ask AIDS too, that we need to answer the questions, what sort of support would teachers need to engage in effective HIV and interactive HIV AIDS education? And what can aid teachers in the perceived clash of expectations? How can we bridge that gap between the fear of the community and the stigma and their classes? The power of dialogue. What happened in the dialogue was the seriousness of it grew as the dialogue went on. Initially, people started to repeat their fears, and that, you know, if you talk to children about these things, they become more promiscuous, that this was licensed to make matters worse. And so we came to believe that dialogue was showing us a powerful possibility of change, and that this could lead to the emergence of a new pedagogy and curricula. And that, in a sense, is what we've been trying to do in phase two.